Why are diamonds so expensive and considered so valuable? Diamonds are not particularly rare, and compared to other colored gemstones, they're the most common precious stone to be found. But if that's the case, why is the price of diamonds and other precious gems rising at such an astronomical rate? Precious gems have increased in value by 5 to 8% every single year since 1995. I'm Christy I, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today we're going to bring some clarity to the often misunderstood diamonds and colored gems market. Diamonds have been coveted and admired for thousands of years for their beauty. They were formed billions of years ago and are so rare because so few are able to survive the difficult journey from the pits of the earth to reach the earth's surface. From the diamonds that are being mined today, only about 20% are high enough quality to be sold on the diamond market as jewelry. But while diamonds are rare, they aren't as rare as you think. Throughout the 19th century, De Beers maintained a monopoly on the global diamonds mines. The cartel would stockpile diamonds, limit supply, and drive up demand and costs. And it would only release enough diamonds to meet annual demand, giving the market the illusion that diamonds were exceedingly rare. But why is a diamond so expensive? Perhaps it has to do with the amount of work it takes to mine a diamond. Diamond mining operates some of the most resource-intensive activities, consuming large amounts of water and energy. You first have to mine the diamond and extract it from its ore. About 133 million carats of rough diamonds are produced each year, with Botswana and Russia being the largest producers. Between them, they have half the world's production. And four diamond producers control about 65% of the market. De Beers, the Russian producer Alrosa, and diversified mining companies BHP and Rio Tinto. Large commercially viable diamond mines are a rarity. And today, there are only about 20 major diamond mines in the world, and only 11 of them make up 62% of the world's production by carat. And no matter how big the mine is, you have to move a lot of rock to get a very small number of diamonds. At even the richest mine, 1 ton of rock contains only about 1.4 carats of rough diamond. Now that's less than 0.3 grams. On average, a producer sells rough diamonds for $134 a carat, giving it a profit margin of 20 to 24%. The miner then has to sort and sell them as jewelry grade diamonds or industrial grade diamonds. Cutters and polishers are next, who buy rough diamonds from the producers and cut them appropriately and polish them to release their true potential. The majority of cutting and polishing is now done in India, followed by China because of low labor costs. Jewelry manufacturers then buy the polished stones, usually at exhibitions, create the piece, set the stones, and give them to retailers to sell finished jewelries to customers. Manufacturers and retailers, depending on the prestige of the brand, can enjoy a premium profit margin of up to 40%. But now, man-made diamonds are growing in popularity. To the average person, these gems are indistinguishable from traditionally mined diamonds. And these lab-grown diamonds, or LGDs, are less expensive and considered an environmentally friendly alternative to mining. They take weeks to create in plasma reactors and have been recognized as, quote, diamonds by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission since 2018. So for more, let's bring in Eden Golan, diamond industry analyst at Diamond Research and Data. So Eden, how has the attitudes towards lab-created diamonds, or LGDs, shifted in recent years? It seems to be gaining traction, with the market expected to double by $6 billion by 2025?
Well, it's an actually interesting question. So lab-growns have been around for a good number of years and have entered the retail marketplace as components in jewelry around 2016. By 2018, they were really already a thing. And at that point, they were, if we looked at all diamonds, that is natural diamonds and lab-grown diamonds together, lab-grown at the time represented about 2% of the business, 1.8 to 2.2, depending really how you measured it. We know that that figure has increased since then. It doubled almost every year, and it currently stands at around 10%. So in terms of value, there's definitely a doubling almost every year. I don't know if we'll reach 6 billion, but there's no doubt that this is an item of growing interest in the consumer market, and we're seeing it growing rapidly at this point.
And while LGDs are trying to position themselves as more ethical compared with the traditional history of diamond mining, are they really, when it takes so much energy to produce them and most of them are made in China?
Well, there isn't one answer to this question. In other words, since it's an industry, some companies are ethical in the sense of labor conditions, impact on the environment, etc. That cannot be said for all companies. There are a number of companies, as you pointed out, in China that have some facing a lot of criticism. Some of it has to do with their energy use and energy use that is not clean. There is a lot of criticism about working conditions in some of these places. So in general, I think we really need to break this down. First has to do with, is it ethical in the sense that it is environmentally friendly? And the other is it ethical in terms of, is it harming anyone? In most cases, we see that both the ethical side and the environmental side kind of go hand in hand. And compared to the majority of natural, if you look at natural diamonds and mining there, the human conditions are by and large fantastic. Workers are unionized in the largest companies. All of the large companies are public companies, so they're facing serious scrutiny. If they do not meet standards, they are reporting on their own ethical and environmental impact, and those are audited. So in that regard, I wouldn't say that lab-grown diamonds are by definition more ethical than natural diamonds.
And the LGD industry claims that its objective is to democratize the diamond industry so that it is more affordable to all. But by doing that, isn't it inherently killing off the diamond industry and taking away the allure of what makes diamonds so valuable and coveted?
So the issue of value is an interesting one. So first of all, the issue of, let's start with democratizing diamonds. Democratizing diamonds really started with De Beers in the 1940s. They very accurately understood that in the post-World War II era, we're looking primarily in the United States enjoying a boom in the growth of the middle class. And that's where Diamond is Forever, the slogan and marketing campaign really kicked in. So up until that point, diamonds were really something that you saw primarily available to the very rich, to royalties, to Hollywood stars, but the average Joe didn't have an opportunity or the financial ability to buy them. Diamond is Forever was a campaign that said, look, let's make sure that everybody has an opportunity and a desire to buy a diamond. So in that regard, what we're seeing is really that the democratization of diamonds began 80 years ago. So that's on one hand. The other hand, so there's the issue of what is the value today? And there is a debate. So one of the tenets of a luxury item is that it's not available to everybody, And it is pricey, so it's the economic aspect of it that makes it less available, as well as the amount and quantity in the market. And in that regard, if we see diamonds being sold for $200, everybody can afford them. Is it right? Is it wrong? I mean, that's a social question. I think everybody should have access to something that they think that A is beautiful, and B makes them feel good. I think the biggest value of a diamond ring, for example, is how does it make you feel? Does it make you feel, and when you gift it, good, and that you made somebody happy? If you're the person being gifted, does it remain a strong and positive memory? Does it make you happy? If the answers are yes, if you look at a diamond and you say, "Wow, I'm so happy I have it," then you have a great item, and that makes it valuable. And at the end of the day, I think that's the most important thing. There's no doubt that the fact that an item will have a sort of a bifurcation of diamonds in the diamond industry. We'll have diamonds that are high priced and as such luxury items, and we expect to see that primarily happening with natural diamonds. On the other hand, we're going to have something that is mass produced, easily accessible. The cost of manufacturing is and growing and will reduce over time, making it more and more accessible. And as such, I don't expect it to be a luxury item as much as it will be a fashion item available to everybody.
Thank you so much, Eden Golan, for your insights. And when we come back, we will discuss the real environmental costs of gems and what is the price countries are willing to pay to get a hold of precious stones. Don't go away.
Chagos Archipelago, home of the Chagosians, Diego Garcia, the largest island in the archipelago, is now the location of a very large U.S. military base.
UK government give our island to the U.S. government to make a military base and just deported all the Chagosan people from their country, so they can't return back on the island.
Never.
Never, but we are fighting. That's why we are fighting for the rights of return.
Respect!
Luma!
Respect!
Luma!
Respect!
Luma!
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. And on the question of self-determination, the legal advice we've received is actually the Chagossians were not and are not a people.
For me, it's time to move on and see what we can do for the Chagossian community to return back home.
There's no support from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
United Nations don't care about Chagossian people.
Welcome back. It's not just diamonds that fascinate us. Colored gemstones have had a resurgence of interest in recent years. For example, the Duchess of Cambridge's sapphire engagement ring, Meghan Markle's aquamarine ring, and Princess Eugenie's coral paparazzi, and more. This has led the sector towards double-digit growth with record prices for emeralds and rubies that surpass the price of diamonds on a per-carat basis. But all that growth comes with a price, which is unfortunately the environment. Towns in rural South Africa like Jagersfontein were destroyed when the dam built to hold back the waste from mining crumbled, sending gray sludge throughout the community. The waste from mining known as tailings is becoming a major problem as poor communities are saddled with toxic waste once all the gems are extracted. A similar dam collapsed in Brazil years ago, killing more than 250 people. Unfortunately, these mines are often in rural areas where operators lack the resources and expertise to manage tailing dams and often skimp in order to save on operational costs. Mining also involves building tunnels and pits, which opens room for soil erosion. Loose sediments will continue accumulating in the nearby bodies of waters, and the land itself will become unfit for agricultural purposes, further promoting deforestation. So now, knowing the true costs of these gems, is it still worth it? Let's bring in Eden Golan, Diamond Industry Analyst at Diamond Research and Data for more. So Eden, people today are increasingly looking to precious metals and colored gemstones as safe assets. What do you make of that, and how do these precious gems such as sapphires, rubies, and emeralds compare to a diamond as an investment asset?
So as an investment, there's a big debate about diamonds. Are they an investment worthy item? And here too, we're seeing that we're looking at with diamonds, we're seeing that not all diamonds are investment worthy diamonds, and there are some that are very much so. So diamonds that have the top color, top clarity, perfect polishing, and in sizes that are very rare, so 5 carats and above, so a D-flowless, what is called a triple excellent 5-carat diamond is rare. And as they get bigger and remain those other characteristics, they become more and more less available in the market. And as such, what we see is that usually at times of crisis, their prices tend to rise. And when we're looking about a time of crisis, we're talking, 9/11, Fukushima, 2008, the COVID pandemic. At those kind of times, what we see is that usually many economic elements are declining. So the stock market, the price of gold sometimes usually goes up, but sometimes goes down. Real estate, which is an important investment, prices of real estate tend to decline. And at those times, when people usually do, is they turn to jewelry for a whole list of reasons, psychological primarily, and emotional. And what we see at those times is because there's a rise in demand, and usually those sort of times it's difficult to mine, which was clearly the case during COVID, prices tend to rise. So as such, some diamonds are no doubt a hedge. So in that regard, they are a good investment for the long term, especially not just the diamonds that I described, but those with unique colors, unusual colors. So pinks, reds, blues are in great demand. And their rarity makes them especially expensive. And so, for example, the Argyle mine in Australia that shut down about 2 years ago was the main source of pink diamonds. Without that mine, there's going to be a lot less pink diamonds coming into the market. So their prices are appreciating. That's the natural trend. In terms of rubies and sapphires, we're seeing those kind of trends with semi-precious gems as well, although not to the same extent. So there are some sapphires and emeralds and rubies that are appreciating in value, but this is primarily when they are attached to an interesting piece of jewelry. So necklaces, crowns, earrings that have a story behind them. So provenance does a lot to increase their value over time. And those are interesting investments. If we talk about investments in terms of, if I go out to the store, my local specialty jeweler, and I buy a 1-carat ring with a typical color clarity combination, Their prices do increase over time, but it's not a real investment opportunity. The whole retail model is based on the idea that I buy wholesale, I mark up the goods a little bit and then sell them. And then when you want to turn back to the store and say, look, you know, I bought this from you for so many dollars in the past, 2, 3, 5, 10 years ago. Now I want, to see, this return on investment. You know, a retailer won't buy it back at a retail price. He'll buy it back at a wholesale price because, that's the basis of the retail business. I buy wholesale and they sell retail. So at times people can feel that they did not see the full appreciation, but mainly it has to do with the fact that they bought within a model that does not encourage to create those kind of transactions.
It seems like several of the top-tier mines have already been depleted. Mines in Myanmar that contain the infamous pigeon blood rubies or Kashmir sapphires or the Golconda mines for diamonds have been long depleted. So do you see other semi-precious stones like opals or aquamarines joining the ranks of the traditional sapphire, rubies, and emeralds?
It's a tricky question. So let's start with what is available and will be available. One of the answers to the question of availability is technology, right? What used to be impossible to reach in the past all of a sudden became available when technology changed, when exploration technologies improved, when conditions have improved. Look at a lot of the diamond mines around the world today, they're underground. And I've been to a diamond mine that started as an open pit, which is a typical mine, and it went more than 600 meters underground. Now, this is technology that didn't exist, many years ago. And today, you're mining diamonds at a kilometer below sea level. So it's really a matter of technology. I had a conversation with the CEO of De Beers, with Bruce Cleaver, who said, look, we're already seeing changes in technology that will allow us to find diamonds in places that in the past we thought they're not there, or in the past we felt that they are a possible resource, but just because of the cost and complexity of mining it, these resources were never developed. And now we're able to develop them, and we already see that the new technology we're working on will help us get there and be able to extract these gems economically. So this is true for all gems. This is not true just for diamonds. It's true for rubies. It's true for sapphires, emeralds, etc. So that's the answer, the first part of the question. Will we see other gems rise and become interesting and precious? Absolutely, it's a possibility. I think that there are a lot of beautiful minerals out there that are not being traded as this very expensive or valuable item. And, tastes change, interests change. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we'll see that some of these items that are today viewed as sort of pedestrian become desirable and of interest. So marketing will have a hand in that. If an interesting brand will come out with a design or a jewelry line that is based on a certain item that will promote it clearly. So it's definitely a possibility.
So we know that the rarity of diamonds is somewhat manipulated by De Beers, who have monopolies. What about the color gems markets? Are the colored precious gems innately scarce, or are there other market forces at play?
It's a common misconception that De Beers is a monopoly that is gaming prices. So let's look at the past. Back in the old days, and I'm talking, 30, 40, 50 years ago, De Beers had an 80% market share. It was a combination of, when I talk about market share, I'm talking by value of rough diamonds. This market share was created not only by the fact that De Beers was the largest diamond miner in the world, it was also the largest marketer. In other words, it would buy diamonds from other companies and marketed jointly. And it made a lot of sense for the exploration, other exploration and mining companies. They didn't have to deal with the marketing process. They didn't have to clean the diamonds. They didn't have to sort the diamonds. They didn't have to maintain a large operation of understanding what's the price of a certain stone out of, you know, 3,000 to 8,000 different ways of breaking. You could break diamonds up to, you know, there's some break it down by 3,000 into 3,000 categories, and some break into 8,000. So there's a lot of issues involved in how do you price and market a diamond. So it was easy to provide it to De Beers. About 20 years ago, the company became very sensitive to the issue of its monopolistic position, and made a couple of changes in the way that it works that changed it. So today, De Beers is about, by value, 30% of the supply to the market. There's another company, Alrosa, that up until about a year ago, when it fell under sanctions, U.S. sanctions, in February 2022, because it's a Russian company. So, but at that point, it was the biggest supplier of diamonds by volume, right? By value, a little bit less. So not only that De Beers isn't the biggest diamond miner anymore, it's you know, some could argue, it's not, not only that, it could be argued that not only that De Beers is not a majority provider, a monopolistic provider to the market, that in fact it's not even the biggest company in the market, because there's another company that sells more by volume.
Thank you so much, Eden Golan, for your time and insight. Now, in the debate between diamonds and colored gems, it is the consumers who will ultimately decide. Are these beautiful stones worth the stress we put on the environment? Is the cost justified when the lands are stripped and rivers polluted? Ultimately, it is up to the consumer to decide if it is worth it to them or if they're happy with a counterfeit. I would say synthetic, since counterfeit has the connotation of deceit and people are not necessarily being deceived. But the beauty of purchasing a stone that has been growing for millions of years and then plucked out of the ground is so special. And no amount of technology could ever replace or even come close to the fascination of a natural stone. But at what cost to the environment? I'm Christy I, thanks for watching, and we'll see you right here next time on The Cost of Everything.